Welcome to the Innovation Station, the new podcast from the Innovation Hub of South Yorkshire and Bassalaw, ICS. This is your quick roundup of health and care innovation within our region and beyond, where we discuss some of the challenges facing the health and care system and highlight how innovation, technology, and new ideas are transforming and improving services to help address these challenges. The Innovation Hub is a partnership between the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network and the South Yorkshire and Bassalaw Integrated Care System. The Innovation Hub works to help the ICS identify unmet needs from across the health and care sector and support the adoption and spread of innovation which can help meet these needs. I'm your host, Ijaz Zahid, Program Director of the Innovation Hub. So for this podcast, we're going to talk about how we build a culture of innovation across South Yorkshire and Bassalaw. And we're delighted to have in the studio today, in our virtual studio, Joe Langley from the Lab for Living, which is a research group at Hallam University that brings together a variety of disciplines, engineering, design, healthcare, etc. Welcome, Joe. Great to have you today.
Thank you very much, Ijaz. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Lab for Living and your role there?
We are an interdisciplinary group of academics who come from engineering, design, a range of different art sort of disciplines, but also health disciplines as well, so occupational therapy, nursing, physiotherapy, and so on. And we came together formally back in about 2008 when we recognised that there had been a number of project collaborations going on across quite a number of years where designers and artists as researchers had been working more and more on specific projects with occupational therapists, nurses and so on from a different research centre. What we decided to do was to actually bring these two different groups of academics together to try to really catalyse these collaborations and give them some critical mass and injection of resources. And since 2008, we've sort of steadily grown with our activity, using the creative disciplines and the creative research methods and practices to explore issues relating to well-being, health, etc., in a number of different contexts. So whether it's about personal individual health, maintaining good health, or supporting management of ill health and long-term conditions, whether that's sort of community-provided care, informal care, or community care services, or whether that's acute care and primary care services in a sort of more official structures. Our work is typified by collaboration with service, both service users and service providers, and other academics with in-depth expert knowledge about specific aspects of either a long-term condition or specific kind of service setup or delivery.
Thanks, Joe. Obviously, Lab for Living is a really valuable resource for the region, bringing together so many different disciplines and different ways of thinking around problem solving. Some of the tools and techniques that you incorporate include things like human-centered design, co-design, and co-production. Could you start by outlining what human-centered design is and how this approach can be used when trying to help transform services and address healthcare challenges?
Human-centered design is a design process, essentially a problem-solving process that puts the humans within that process at the heart of any solution or efforts to improve the service. It's based on the experiences of people who either use that service or deliver it, and sort of sets out with the premise that we should be enhancing the experience of both those people delivering a service and those people receiving a service. It doesn't just focus on the functional forms of engagement or delivery of a product or services. It also recognises that people have emotional relationships with services and products, whether they're delivering them or receiving them. And so we look at that very holistically. The thinking of this is about building empathy with those people. And it starts way before people actually might start practically engaging with a product or service. So, you know, their thought process when they're starting to think about, should I engage with this service, or, you know, do I need to engage with this product? And then follows through not just the sort of actual usage scenario or scenarios, but afterwards to the sort of legacy impacts of, you know, those services or products and how they have affected those people.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, and one thing that I got from what you just said there is that when we think about humans in those services, We're not just thinking about, you know, the service users within the healthcare context, also the clinicians and staff that are involved in delivering those services are also users of that system, and making sure that service is user-friendly from their perspective is as important as it is for it to be user-friendly from the patient's perspective. There's some fantastic examples of how people have applied, you know, human-centered design in healthcare. One really interesting example that I've often thought about is, I think it was one of these big companies like Siemens that were developing an MRI machine for a children's hospital. From a technical perspective, designed perfectly for kids. When they had the inaugural event a few days after that, I think the chief designer went to the hospital where it was set up. On his way into the hospital, he was horrified to see a lot of kids coming out of the MRI service who, with a terrified look on their faces, many of them crying, and got really upset by what he saw. Many kids were coming back without actually having had their MRI because they just weren't prepared for the MRI session. He went back to his design team and came back a few weeks later, and they walked around the hospital on their knees, empathizing with the kids, looking at, from the kids' perspective, you know, what the experience feels like, you know, walking through the front door all the way through to the MRI machine. They didn't redesign the machine, but they revamped the whole MRI experience from start to finish. And they redesigned the MRI rooms. So one of them was around like a pirate ship theme. So each one of those has had a different kind of theme around it. But the theme didn't start just at the MRI room. When the child or the parent was sent the referral for an MRI session, it came as a little storybook. And the storybook theme was based around whatever MRI room they were going to go into. And it was amazing. They went from something like, I think, 20% uptake rate to 80%. So that's the power of human-centered design.
What I love about that example is it illustrates so many different things. It's not just, you know, for example, the physical perspective of, you know, going around on your hands and knees to look up at things, which is literally taking a very different perspective. And as you said, building empathy. It's also recognizing that these processes don't start when you open that door into the MRI room. It starts way before that. People build up expectations about things, and all of these have a real impact on how people engage with the service. I mean, if the very first moment or interaction with a product or service is poor, it doesn't matter if the rest of the experience is actually good. Because of that very first moment, you've got a poor perspective of the whole experience. This is where, as designers of the service, we need to think that far back and start to explore how we can sort of set expectations or help people set their own expectations and manage them. Because those are the things that then reduce barriers to people engaging with services. That's the thing that sort of leads to fewer missed appointments. This is why, you know, just sort of simply doing research about people and then using that isn't good enough. This is why we need to engage with those people in the process, because working with those people hand in hand means that you always have that sort of first-hand richness of their experience, much of which they won't be able to articulate. This is why, as designers, we say, well, just work with people right from the start, all the way through that process. And then you're less likely to lose any of that sort of complex, hidden, tacit sort of knowledge that, you know, otherwise as research, however thorough you are, you might not ever sort of tap into.
Thanks, Joe. So we also hear about the term user-centered design. I know that at a national level, NHS England, NHS Digital and NHSX are investing heavily in developing user-centered design teams, which will support services at a national level. Are you able to explain how that might differ from human-centered design, if at all? Or is it the same thing?
Okay, so there's something really interesting about the semantics of these labels and how people use them. There's an academic I admire hugely called Professor Trish Greenhow, who's based at the University of Oxford, who spoke very eloquently on Twitter about how she's often asked to engage with sort of people trying to create standardized definitions of this, that and the other. And she sort of said that it's often a futile process because language being what it is, people will use words in their own way to mean their own thing. And rather than actually trying to nail down a standardized definition when language will inevitably evolve anyway, why not just sort of ask people what they mean by things? So I can sort of tell you what I understand by those terms and the differences between them, but I think it's always best to try to, whether it's human-centred design, user-centred design, co-design, participatory design, co-creation, co-production, explain what you mean by it and ask someone else what they mean by it before, you know, leaping to any kind of conclusions. That's my sort of overarching recommendation for this sort of stuff. My understanding of the difference between human-centred design and user-centred design is that human-centred is sort of very holistic and includes that sort of technical ways and practical ways and functional ways in which people engage with the product or service, as well as the emotional ways, whereas user-centered design probably focuses slightly more on the practical, the functional elements, and perhaps less so on the emotional. I think the other important distinction that I would like to make is that there's often an assumption that human-centered and user-centered means working with people, and that's not necessarily true. You can have anthropometric data about the size and shape of people, their hands and so on, and use that to make it a human-centered design without necessarily always directly speaking to someone or working with someone in that design process. So this is why we prefer to talk about the sort of participatory and co-design, because they are inherently human-centered, but they also emphasize that you're working with those people rather than just designing for them.
You just mentioned two other terms, co-design and co-production. If you could just give us a little bit more of an explanation about what co-design means and what co-production means.
They are both inherently human-centered processes, but they are also both participatory processes. So it's working with people who are affected by that service or product or whatever is being developed or explored. Relating it to design, engineering and sort of manufacturing terms, production is always for me about the way in which a service might actually be delivered. So it's not just about how a service is researched, explored, developed and designed, but also the actual delivery of it. So if there is a community, a third sector organization to understand and navigate that pathway and all the various different systems and processes, it would be beneficial for them to go through. That's a real example of co-production. That's where, you know, professional services and community people are coming together to make a service into reality. I slightly position co-design more at that exploration and development end of the process, where it's about working with service providers and service users to really understand what the current experiences are around a service or a product, where those are good and bad, how they differ for different people in different contexts, and what we can do to make them better.
Fantastic. It's a very different way of thinking also for what we're typically used to in the health and care system. What you're talking about here is very much a circular process, isn't it? Where do you see opportunities to embed this kind of design mindset further with those working in the health and care system of South Yorkshire and Bassetlaw?
I think there are some fantastic examples globally. So one only has to look at the Mayo Clinic, who are, you know, one of the gold standard exemplars of, you know, health service delivery within the world. And they have embedded within their actual organization a design and innovation team. They recruit and employ designers under a clinical director. They have a design director and a clinical director, and it's a team of people from digital design backgrounds, from service design backgrounds, from graphic design backgrounds, from product design backgrounds. And they work with other departments in the organization, in the hospital. They do some work to explore sort of organizational and system level challenges and problems. They do some work with individual units or teams or wards to look at experiences of both from professionals and from patients using those and family. They use sort of data collected through surveys of patients and service users. And they use all of this to identify areas where they can carry out improvement projects. I went over there and spent a day with them. One of the things they do is that members of staff within the IT department do placements within the innovation team on a rota. So they come in, They spend 6 months to a year working with the innovation team and then go back and someone else from the team replaces them. And what this does is it ensures two things. One, that the members of the IT team have an open-minded approach to innovations. It's not closed off. Let's work with these things. Let's be a bit flexible. Let's try stuff. But equally, the innovation team have a greater understanding of IT structures. There are some things which are more rigid and some things which are more flexible, some things which are easier to change and some things which are much, much more challenging. And they do this also with clinical staff. So clinical staff will do placements within the innovation team from different wards or different services. And again, it has that same value of building a more pervasive culture of innovation. Because over time, everyone within the whole organisation has spent time within that dedicated innovation focus. But there are other models that have benefited. I mean, within South Yorkshire, we can also point to the previous clerks. So these were parts of the National Institute for Health Research, NIHR funding, which set up collaborations between academics and healthcare providers within the South Yorkshire region. There was a dedicated investment as part of the Clark team with design. Lab for Living were part of that team and part of that initiative. So for a period of 10 years, over two rounds of NIHR Clark funding in South Yorkshire, there was a really specific design focus, which led to a number of design-led or design-focused innovation projects and co-design projects across Doncaster, Rotherham, Barnsley, Sheffield. Everyone has those capacities to solve problems. And I think what we should be doing is both of those things. It's about developing the innate capacities within each and every individual to build that culture of innovation. But also, where issues are really complex, let's not try to just do things on a budget or shoestring. Let's acknowledge that there is a really valuable set of skills and experiences and resources that sits within a very specific discipline and try to find ways of bringing that in and collaborating with it.
Thanks, Joe. That was really insightful. We've been really lucky to be working with your team in the Innovation Hub. And we've started with you a series of regular forums, which gives some key health and care staff from across the region a little bit of time out from their day-to-day jobs to come together and collaborate with each other and with us, and to learn some of these processes and methodologies that we've talked about today. Would you be able to talk a little bit about these innovation labs and what your ambitions are, you know, over the next year as you work with us developing these labs?
Over the next 12 months, we've got a series of four innovation labs. We've had the first one. And in between, we've got something that might be a bit of homework, I guess, trying to build up people's skills and way of thinking about design. The first one will be something like an observation activity. This is, you know, being able to see beyond our own norms as individuals, our own personal norms, is really important for design work. So the common challenge we set people is to photograph 100 thresholds. You know, the first 10 will be easy. You'll just photograph your neighbour's door, your front door. But then once you get to a certain point, finding the difference becomes harder. And people always struggle for a day or so. And then suddenly you go, well, actually, the threshold to a bus, that's a threshold, or a car. Then you start thinking bigger and smaller. So it might be the threshold to a bird cage. All of these are different kinds of thresholds, but you have to get to that point of where it's difficult and challenging to suddenly go, how can I rethink this? Then a kind of second line of activities between the innovation labs will be more focused on the process of sort of identifying unmet needs within each person's own organization. And then selecting some of those and hopefully going through a process of developing some kind of solution for each one. So again, to add a little bit of more fun to this, we're going to try and make it slightly competitive. Each organisation has been set a target and you have to try and identify more unmet needs compared to the neighbouring organisation or whatever it is. Across the four events, so the first one, we're going to be inviting a number of different expert voices and providers and services. So at the last one, we had NHSX, we had Care Opinion, we had Health Watch, the NIHR MedTech Cooperatives. At the next three events, we're going to have similar kind of organisations that might be able to provide specific input to that stage of process as we work through. The next event will be focused more on, once you've identified an unmet need, how do you validate it? Is it at a local scale? Is it just for that patient or just for that service? Is it organisational? Is it for a population of patients? Is it regional? You know, what's the scale of this? Again, looking at it from different perspectives, the patient's perspective, the service provider professional's perspective, the organisational perspective, etc. And once you've validated different unmet needs, it's that selection process. What do we focus on? And also looking at, you know, before jumping to let's develop a new solution, it's that idea of let's look at other contexts. Let's look in other places. Let's look in other organisations. What can we borrow? Not just within healthcare, but more broadly. This is, again, where I think designers can have a really valuable input. There was a fantastic example I've got of a guy called Matthew Tully. Really, really lucky to be able to work with on a number of different small projects. We were looking at cardiac bypass surgery with a cardiac surgeon from Sheffield Teaching Hospitals. Matthew was bringing this knowledge that he had from previous work, years, decades before, where he had been working with intercontinental oil and gas pipelines. So the diameter of them is massive. But obviously they can't stop the flow of oil or gas if something's wrong with the pipe. So over time, they've developed these processes for examining pipes and repairing and maintaining pipes without stopping the flow of oil or gas. It's a process called hot tapping. And so we were like, well, what happens if we try and take the concepts of that and apply it to blood vessels? It's the same thing at a different scale. Can we keep blood flowing through those vessels whilst we're trying to do repair work on the vessels without interrupting the flow of blood? So we tried it in a wet lab in Barnsley. We worked with a pig cadaver, and the cardiac surgeon came down, and there was Matthew Tully and myself there, and we spent 2 hours trying to do this on a pig. And ultimately in that instance it didn't work, but that idea of being able to take the concepts from one very different industry or sector. And I think there's a skill to be able to see those potential translations and just go, well, let's try that. How can we rework that and make it valid? So that's what the next session is going to focus on.
Fantastic. I think one of the organizations that we're inviting in that expert section for the next Innovation Lab will be the Knowledge Transfer Network, which is part of Innovate UK and has tentacles in lots of industries. And a lot of their role is to actually transfer knowledge from one industry to another where it could benefit. So it'll be really interesting and exciting to hear what they have to say, what sorts of resources they can provide.
I think it's more than valuable. I think it's essential. I really do. I mean, I'm passionate about this. We know that at every level of sort of human society, diversity is a real valuable choice, whether it's genetics of diversity gives us a stronger gene pool, cultural diversity enriches our lives more. Diversity of thought and thinking and perspective in innovation is what creates those opportunities for real leaps, real kind of radical change. I mean, within our own team at Lab for Living, one of my colleagues is originally a historian, but she then went on to become an occupational therapist and a photographer and a designer. That meandering career path is part of what gives her that sort of valuable breadth of perspective and diversity that she brings to her work. I would really recommend that within organisations, trying to identify people who have that sort of diverse career jumping background, not to say that they're the only ones, but they often make really, really good candidates. There's an example of an intensive care consultant at Sheffield Children's Hospital who used to be a technologist for Apple, and then decided on a career change and went into medicine and became an intensive care consultant. And he developed an app for prescribing, which is one of the first and perhaps the only medical device prescribing apps in the world.
Fantastic. I just wanted to touch upon any potential barriers from your experience, which may prevent, you know, the nurturing of this mindset.
I think organizational culture is the biggest thing that can sort of stifle or become a barrier. But leaders in whatever level, whatever position, if they can be open to just giving people a little bit of freedom and scope to try some of these things in terms of taking barriers away, that kind of approach where leaders can just be prepared to give people a little bit of freedom and scope to do stuff. The final implementation of stuff is always a much bigger problem than people anticipate at the start. And it's always worth thinking about sort of implementation as the right at the start of the process, all the way through as a common thread. How is this going to work in practice? How is this going to work in context? How is this going to work? Being prepared for that implementation at the end to be slightly more demanding than you ever anticipated. is my probably parting point of advice I'd leave people with.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to have you on the Innovation Station today. We're looking forward to continuing to work with you over into the new year. And yeah, I think that wraps it up. Thank you for listening in to the Innovation Station. That was a fantastic conversation with Joe Langley from Lab for Living. We're delivering a series of Innovation Lab events over the next year. If you're listening to this and are currently working in an ICS partner organization in South Yorkshire and Bassett Law, we'd highly encourage you to attend. You've been listening to The Innovation Station, the podcast of the South Yorkshire and Bassett Law Innovation Hub. The Innovation Hub is a partnership between the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network and the South Yorkshire and Bassett Law Integrated Care System. The Innovation Hub works to help the ICS identify unmet needs from across the health and care sector and support the adoption and spread of innovation which can help meet these needs. I'm your host, Ijaz Zahid, Program Director of the Innovation Hub.